And we are live. This is Dark Journalist. It's great to see everyone here. It's a large crowd for us on this special Saturday night show. And of course, we have the lovely Olivia with us. There's an echo in here.
Yes, there was. Hi, everyone.
How are you? I know you're already charged up for tonight. I can feel it. There's a lot of electricity in the air. And one of the great things about tonight is that, well, we're doing a double hitter here because this is part two of the part X of the X series. And what we've got is something kind of special happening because we've been leading this X series where it took us based on all the evidence we've been putting together. And I'm going to go into just what the foundation is briefly. But tonight, we're going to get to what it looks like the core of the X issue is and where that X development took us and how far back in history it goes. So this is really the crucial episode because it is, after all, the 10th episode of the X series. And this is the end of that first phase of investigation of the X. As I said last night, we're going to do another 10 episodes on it, going deeper still. But tonight is so important because it's going to take all of that information from the first 9 episodes plus last night. And we don't usually do a Saturday night show, as you know. We're usually Fridays at 7. But this one, it was really a two-parter because there's so many implications on the technology side, for starters. And then we had all of this mystery school information coming in through the variants. And the variants we got into last night were a family that basically gave Silicon Valley a tremendous boost and were responsible for helping us win World War II with their incredible innovations in microwave radiation technology. So we went deep and far and wide into the RAD and what that was all about. And really, the RAD Lab is something that it hasn't been lost, but it sort of skipped over when people are looking for that incredible technological development. But there we had in the RAD Lab at MIT some of the best, greatest minds, and really some of the most scientific output that was available in the country at the time. And they were all hovered in around this X technology. Now, their incredible achievements are interesting, but for us, looking back at their legacy, we're looking at people who come from these different ranks of society, and some of them incredibly high ranking, like Trump's uncle, John G. Trump, who's in the RAD Lab with Professor Vannevar Bush, who was also the National Science Director who dealt directly with all these presidents. So we bring all these things in together. And one of the things that Olivia can attest to is that when I was looking up the box that they have for all John Trump's papers at MIT, I kid you not, it is box X. So that's where they kept all of the papers relating to John Trump and MIT.
It's amazing.
I'll show that to you tonight. I forgot to last night, but I think it is important because it shows that continuity in the X. And tonight, though, we're going to go deep into what the mystery schools were telling us through the figures of two of the real heavyweights of esoteric thought that really bring us to the brink of understanding the entire thing. And then we decide, do we want to dive in and understand what they're talking about or go on our merry way? Of course, Rudolf Steiner, one of the most sort of acclaimed and yet also underground because his work is not so well understood. Rudolf Steiner, who really started anthroposophy and was a close member in theosophy for a decade before he did that, and he sort of turned his sights elsewhere after theosophy got into this whole thing about bringing the world teacher on in a hurry because they felt society needed it. And he just felt that they weren't following the original mandate of theosophy. But Steiner really, his course had been set at a very young age when this kind of illiterate gardener had introduced him to psychic techniques and had actually been a messenger for a master that wanted to groom Steiner to bring these truths out to the world. And that was associated with a mystery school, and it became the key influence in Steiner's life. I would say that Steiner's work, I feel I probably know the best besides Casey's work, because there's something about Steiner's work which reaches into so many different areas, and the translations are German to English, so sometimes there's a little bit of a language barrier, but there's such a consistency in the work that he's putting out. And basically he has a message, which is that we're in the key period. We're in the key phase of human development. This is where it is. And I was saying last night that his message was just ever so slightly different. Well, I mean, it's remarkably different from Theosophy, but in terms of the future, it was a little bit different in this sense, which is that Theosophy was bringing on this whole idea of the six root race, which is absolutely fascinating, and something, a human development coming forward, you know, the new human, that kind of thing. And they just seemed loaded with this optimism. And Steiner is far from gloomy, but he realizes that there's a big test coming up, which is crucial, and the stakes are incredibly high. All of evolution is at stake, in his opinion. So we're going to get into what he sees us entering into, but it's basically this period of the next 100 years. And it's an absolutely crucial period for humanity. And that's something I really locked into, because I felt like Steiner was almost sent out there as a, you know, a primer to get us ready 100 years early. And remember, this is someone who went through World War I, so he certainly understood just how intense things could get when the social order broke down. Being in Germany during World War I, it's pretty much a nightmare scenario. And then the other heavy hitter that we're going to get deep, deep, deep into tonight is Edgar Cayce. And Edgar Cayce, still not very well understood, in my opinion. He's often taken advantage of by tabloids who say, Cayce predicted this. Or stooges who come out and say, I was Edgar Cayce. You know, we have enough of those. I remember talking with Edgar Evans Cayce and Cayce's son at the ARE and asking him all these amazing things about all these readings. But then in just some little minor chit-chat going back and forth, we were trading things about the ARE. And I said, what's the kind of the worst thing about all this? And he was like, well, you know, we have two things that really come up a lot. One is people pretending to be the reincarnation of John the Baptist and coming to the Cayce Foundation and saying, hey, you have to recognize me, I'm John the Baptist. And the other one is people coming around and saying they're the reincarnation of Edgar Cayce. So it's actually quite common. But this really detracts from some of the incredible work that Cayce did. And I don't think that when we look at other psychics and other work, we can really put many of them in the same category. I would say that he was an absolute A-lister in terms of the documented work of his readings. And I would also say that it's something very crucial about Cayce that he definitely, you know, when you look at psychics and all this stuff, we've gotten into a period where they charge these amazing fees and it's all about building your brand and things like that. You know, Cayce really used his intuition and prayed a lot about the work he was doing. And he had a lot of struggles with it, being a Christian and doing these trance readings that were bringing through things about reincarnation and other things. Very, a kind of esoteric Christianity, certainly anchored in Christianity, but very different from that kind of Sunday school world. But his readings are absolutely fascinating. There are thousands of readings, many readings done on the health of individuals where he could go into trance, very much like these kind of mesmeric trances that we've been mentioning in these X episodes. And he would be able to diagnose these different bodies and the different ailments that they had, much like a doctor would just by looking at a slip of paper of a name and an address. Now, this is quite a remarkable ability. We might have good psychics now who could say, well, you have some good job opportunities coming up. Or, you know, your romance will blossom. But to be able to actually diagnose somebody's health ailments and have over and over and over again these incredible results with people really makes Cayce's work stellar. But there's something about Cayce's work I want to mention, which is that he understood in these trance states that the idea was twofold, it was about attunement and service, so that if he attuned and got this incredible rapport going with his higher self and, you know, with the kind of unseen realm, then a lot of people are just satisfied with that. They want to attune and all this stuff. But he understood that it was all about attunement and service, and that without attuning and then, you know, feeding that energy out in service, that it was like a kind of a volcano overflowing. It's a chaotic situation. So it's very important, that principle that he brought forward with his life. At the same time, although he did a lot of self-sacrificing and all the rest of it, something we need to understand about Casey up front is that the image that's portrayed of him in these books as this kind of, you know, do-gooder guy who had these simple ideas in his readings about, you know, believing in God and all these things about being good, and sort of a goody-two-shoes kind of image, is really, you know, Casey's work is brings together incredible worlds, and his readings on Atlantis are still some of the edgiest things I've ever seen in my life, because he's talking about technology that they had where they could create ships that would disappear that had cloaking abilities, that they had the ability to talk to beings in the outer spheres, that they were able through the technology to communicate with the spirit world and bring that information back. So it's such an edgy picture for somebody doing readings, let's say, in the 1920s, that it's the most remarkable body of work, you know, a psychic has left behind, in my opinion. And I think we find as we go more and more into his work and how he did it, that it's some of the most reliable psychic material that we have. So between Casey and Steiner, we're looking at a good, solid base of information to guide us through the X steganography. Now, briefly, for people who are new to the X series, we've got about 10 episodes up, and this is part two of the 10th episode, which deal with this idea that there's an ongoing symbol, there's an ongoing reference symbol to, in the 20th century, in the 21st century, an advanced technology, which comes largely from our observing what happens with the UFO file, which, as we know, is quite a remarkable thing to follow. But one of the things I was doing in my research is I kept coming up against the X. That is, I was finding these presidents would have things like the X letter. At the LBJ Library, for example, there's an X letter to be opened 50 years after his death in 2023. I found that Eisenhower had a Project X time capsule to be opened in 2053. We heard from whistleblowers and other individuals who worked with Richard Nixon that he kept a time capsule which contained X. And you know, so we have this kind of thread of this X going through these different political institutions and then in situations. And then when I was looking into these projects, the high-tech projects of the 40s, 50s, and 60s, as soon as they got to that level that where they went black, and we did a good examination of this with the Blue Gemini program, this X branding would come up so that all these high-speed planes would be marked X and all these projects would be marked X. And then X seemed to be the thing where you could follow that UFO file as it got integrated into the government and into these military programs, into military contractors, and into corporate industry. So that was one way to do it. Now, steganography, as I've pointed out, is a different type of system than cryptology, where we're looking at something that is not meant to look like it's hidden. It is not a code to crack. It's something that is hidden in plain sight. And if you can get someone who knows, who can look at it and understand what it is, then it's done its job. And it was developed among alchemists. It's a very old thing. You might even find evidence of steganography in some of the older cultures like Sumer and Egypt. But steganography is something crucial for us to understand because in light of all this secrecy and in the face of the wall of secrecy, the way the government runs on these and the way that, you know, the individuals involved in the corporations run around these different secrecy issues relating to technology now here in the 21st century, we don't have access. We don't have the tools to be able to understand what's actually happening. When we get something like an understanding of steganography, and the X becomes our doorway into all of these secret projects that they're working on. We get to see through them to the things and the fears that they have and the things that they need to deal with. We get an understanding of what they're dealing with, and that adds to our understanding of why they're holding these secrets and what the secrets are. That's where this is rolling. And it has a political thrust for certain in looking at it. It has a historical thrust. But what I was finding as I was going through it was it has a massive esoteric thrust. And that thrust is really what we're talking about in the X series. There is a gigantic mystery school influence of hidden information that has also been holding this X secret. And someone, you know, we could look at it for the purposes of the 21st century or over the past 70 years and say the X related to the UFO thing. And that's fine. You know, we can look at it just from that vantage point because it does. It's easy to track from the UFO file in the 1940s through all these different programs. That gives us an idea of the update for where we are now. However, the more I went into it, the more I looked into it, I found I was face to face and we were face to face with this thing going back through the Middle Ages, through the 1500s, you know, certainly through the 17th and 18th century, the 19th century. It went all the way back to the Pythagorean school. We were looking at Plato using it. So what I came to realize about it was it seemed to be referring specifically in the cases of mystery schools and in relation to exotic technology. It seemed to be referring, it was actually referring to an effect. So as opposed to saying, you know, as best I could tell, the effect itself is what is being hidden. And that kind of effect, we get an idea, you know, for example, when we talk about things like when people see UFOs and things of that nature, there's all this time distortion, they have missing time, you know, electrically things go haywire, the people themselves seem kind of frazzled. It's a reality distorter of a sort. And I think the larger picture of X, when you get away from just looking at it through the lens of the UFO file, when you're looking in history at the secrets that the mystery schools are keeping, they're actually holding some kind of a vouchsafed image for us, which is that there's an effect that takes place when we engage with an unseen realm, and that the effect is so heavy duty that if it gets in the wrong hands, things could go very badly for the entire group of humanity. And I think that that is what they have been keeping. And we have a lot of keys to it that we've been going through, including what we studied last night. But I do think when we look at this, we have to say that the mystery schools have done a damn good job in a way of trying to help mankind through many different centuries. Now, there have been their opposite numbers, who are secret societies that are dedicated to other things. So we're going to talk about them tonight in the tremendous clash. What I've put, just for the sake of putting it out there, is these two opposing forces. I think we can nail it based on the work of the two individuals we're talking about, is the Great White Brotherhood on one side, which is an esoteric entity of higher beings that in theosophy would contain all of the masters of theosophy. So Maitreya and, you know, Saint Germain, this whole group would be in the White Brotherhood. And the White Brotherhood having to do, they're talking there about auras, and they're talking there about the significance of the Brotherhood through time. So there's no kind of racial connotation or anything like that. It was way before, it was named way before there was any kind of tensions along that line. And it has to do with the kind of purity of outlook, achieving a certain level of esoteric knowledge that's matched with ethical, you know, a kind of ethics that's born of a deep spiritual connection. So it's an incredible group. And when you study these esoteric traditions, the Great White Brotherhood is dead set in the center of the esoteric traditions that came out over the last, say, couple hundred years. But they're referring to something that's much older. On the opposite team, on the opposite side, is Ahriman and the Ahrimanic forces that Steiner brought forward. And Steiner's unique in this because he's using a Persian name there for evil. And this character, Ahriman, had this battle with Ahura Mazda, who is kind of the hero of the Persian religions. And Ahura Mazda has to engage with and sort of take down Ahriman. And Ahriman is this incredible sweeping darkness force. But Ahriman, in Steiner's eyes, is very, very interesting because he is actually the kind of regent, if you were, of these darker astral realms. And his main purpose that he's been setting up sounds very much, when you read Steiner's work, like the transhumanist movement, largely, which is, in effect, he wants to turn the Earth into a gigantic machine, and he wants the kind of people involved and the control of humanity, basically. He wants that to be something that creates a new evolution for humanity, as opposed to the path of evolution that they're on, attaining a kind of enlightened journey over a course of many lifetimes. So we're going to get deep into something called the Eighth Sphere tonight, which is an artificial evolutionary path that Ahriman has set up. And so far, so good. How are we doing over there, Olivia?
Doing great.
Super. So let's just take a quick look at Rudolf Steiner. I always say you can get quite a bit from looking in someone's eyes. And when I look into Steiner's eyes, I see a great amount of knowledge. And really, I've read Steiner since I was a teenager. So after a while, you get a feel for someone's material. And I have to say, Steiner's one of the most unusual. You know, we're lucky to have him. It's one of those things when you look at it, he really stands out because not only did he create all this spiritual information dealing with our evolution and Ahriman and the Great White Brotherhood and all of these different levels. But things like biodynamic farming, eurythmy, the Waldorf schools, these were all developed by Steiner and come out of his movement. And really, his many years spent at Theosophy helped him gain an understanding of how to put together a spiritual group. There's no question about that. So it was certainly helpful, but he had to cut away at a certain point and form his own thing. And I think that the battle there, the challenge there, was that Theosophy was predominantly moving in an Eastern direction. It was going into Buddhism, and Steiner's idea was very simple, which is that the next level, that the Buddhists and this kind of Eastern wave had brought us to a point, and it was time, now that there were 2,000 years of Christianity, that Christianity had matured enough to take on the esoteric mantle and move forward. And he actually spoke about Western initiators versus Eastern initiators, and how the time for Eastern initiation was this period a few thousand years ago that brought us to this incredible level. But now it was up to the Western initiators. But there were those who were so enamored of Buddhism and were so enamored of the Eastern initiators that we were going to kind of revert and go back if we didn't make the Western tradition stand up and accept things like reincarnation and accept things like Ahriman and some of this deeper understanding. So he felt that the esoteric Christianity, it was the time for esoteric Christianity. And so he framed the battles that we were in these unusual, this is some anthroposophic art, but you see these almost kind of angelic realms, and there's a lot of that which anyone who deals with the Steiner work will tell you, whenever you get around that stuff, it puts you in a certain frame of mind. There's no question about it. There's something that Steiner is trying to put forward in the architecture, in the color development, in the early childhood development of Waldorf schools, to change our frame of mind, to move us into a kind of a higher level of understanding. And I would say people who've been in those schools, you know, who have done Waldorf, and of course I've had nieces in Waldorf, and I've had many friends who've gone through that. And it's a remarkable kind of education. And much like Montessori, the idea is that there's a kind of a freedom inside that you need to bring out in early childhood development. Okay, so let's talk about the nemesis. I did show this one actually last night before we get into the nemesis, which is Besant with Steiner when he was still a very faithful theosophist and at her side, really helping her develop the German chapter. And the two of them were quite a team. What happened was Besant was much tighter with Ledbetter overall, and Steiner and Ledbetter had this kind of challenge over Steiner wanting to go more into this kind of Western direction with it, and Ledbetter really all in on the Buddhism side. So, you know, there's a lot of different ways to look at that, and certainly theosophy, when they went all in pushing this idea of the world teacher through Krishnamurti, which the idea was to get a vessel, a pure vessel. And so they chose Krishnamurti, who was a young, impoverished boy. And he was a quite remarkable teacher. They chose an amazing person. But it wasn't his idea. It was theirs. And so after a while, he dissolved what they set up for him, the Order of the Star. And that was kind of the end of the traditional lineage of theosophy. Although, as I've shown, groups like Halcyon and other groups had interesting offshoots of theosophy that did incredible things, like what the Varians did at the Rad Lab and where we started. So I hope all that's clear. And if any of that, in terms of the Rad Lab or the X steganography, if you need more clarity on it, there are 9 episodes back there to go through. And I do recommend that you start with them one at a time. So a quick point, which is that before we get into everything, we're going to be taking questions in the second half of tonight. And Olivia, how would you like them to give me those questions?
Please, in all caps, if you could. And can I ask you a question right away?
Yes.
Because I don't know the answer to this. Are we going to be covering Kenninger and Stell tonight? Do they make it into this episode?
Well, Kenninger and Stell pop up in a few of these episodes, and they might pop up tonight also. And Stell is also a very interesting intentional community that started in Illinois and definitely had an interesting start. We'll try to touch on them. If somebody's really interested in that, we'll definitely weave that in. So yeah, Olivia, ask her all your questions in caps. That's the best way to go. She'll put them aside and we'll deal with them in the second half of the show. I do feel like it's important to say, I've looked at the chats and the chats are so great and so informative, and you and I can exchange ideas there, which is why I always say, the other thing that I want everyone to do is go to darkjournalist.com, sign up for the newsletter. It's a free newsletter and that keeps us in touch. In case YouTube shuts down or net neutrality goes south or whatever they try to pull, if you and I are in that email setup, and what will happen is about once a week, you'll get a direct message from us in your inbox telling you what shows are coming up and all the rest of it. If you want to subscribe to the site at that point, go ahead and do it. There's a lot of material and a lot of exciting material coming up that you're going to want to have access to. Now, that said, and with the questions, what I've noticed is I do want to share this with everyone. You don't have to ask the questions multiple times. And, Olivia is incredibly fast on the draw, and nagging Olivia is not a good idea. I can tell you that.
No, but if you do, it is helpful if to ask me whether I did see it, because sometimes it moves so fast I don't catch it. So just ask me and I can see whether I got it or not.
Yeah. Oh, that's a little bit different. What I'm talking about is the kind of, the pushy, insistent stuff. I've seen it, and trust me, Olivia, she definitely is juggling enough as it is. But we really have to say, when it comes to this, that we're taking the conversation to another level, because one of the things I brought up last night that I think is so important, and I'm going to spend just about 60 seconds on this, is that we're in an environment around alternative media and around alternative research where we have the opportunity, the chance to go a lot deeper. And what I've been seeing is people dragging everyone into political fights left and right. And it seems like the high speed kind of, you know, guy with a blood vessel about to burst in his brain routine is on overdrive. And we've had a lot of disinfo stuff hanging around, like a lot of these Q things, which are falling apart now, with strange anonymous people putting things up, saying that they're working closely with Trump and all that. It's nonsense. But I think that I've been equating it with George Orwell in 1984, because in 1984, they had this thing called 2 Minutes Hate. And in 2 Minutes Hate, they would give the population this enemy who they set up as Goldstein, who was an imaginary enemy. And then they would, you know, show images of an invading army coming forward, and the crowd would get all worked up, and they'd get their hate out in 2 minutes, and they go back to work. And in the meantime, they got all this adrenaline going, and it kept them in a kind of semi-hypnotic state. And I see a lot of that going on the independent side. We know the mainstream media practices that. And when they turn on those high beams, watch out, right? Because we get stuck in the middle of that very often. But when I see it a lot on the independent side, I have to point it out, one, that is not a way for us to learn anything. What I'm trying to do is get us to a point where, if we can understand something like the X steganography, for example, we get a much better handle on the system. And that's much better than kind of, you know, crucifying some political figure and constantly putting up things about, oh, they should go to jail or whatever it is. In the grand scheme of things, I don't think that helps us really move our consciousness into the right place to develop the right type of atmosphere for growth and, you know, to learn new things and to really improve the culture. So don't take the bait on that. I guess that's my message there. Okay, back to the show. Now, when we look at what Casey and Steiner represent, one of the key things that came forward in the period that they're in now, we're talking really their work coming forward about 1910 to 1940. That's the window. Steiner died in 25, but his work really in that window of time, his work came out, because a lot of it was translated and booted over here, and little bit at a time got through. So when you look at it, you know, things like the Waldorf schools and stuff, they sort of grow after he dies. So we're looking at World War I and World War II, really. And these are incredible, challenging periods. And in a way, the brotherhoods and the mystery schools coming forward with work like Steiner's, work like Casey, is absolutely crucial. One of the key things they start talking about is the lost continent of Atlantis. And this is significant for a few reasons. One, it's a secret now that the mystery schools are letting out. And according to Steiner, there was a lot of debate about what to let out in relation to this. And the fact that Atlantis had advanced technology, and airships in particular, that is something that we need to go deep into. And I've done it in a number of shows, that airships are the things that Theosophy talks about. Airships are the things that Bulwer Lytton talks about in his novels in the 1870s. The Atlantean airships are a key focus also in the Steiner work and also in Edgar Casey's work. Why are they all talking about this advanced culture of Atlantis, and why are they attributing all these incredibly high-tech achievements to it? Well, there's a kind of racial memory there, a kind of karmic memory of this incredible, powerful period of time where we possessed incredible technology and almost destroyed humanity and the world and the chance at Earth evolution with it. And we did that through something that Casey calls the Two-Eye Stone. The Two-Eye Stone is an incredible, powerful crystal, and I'm going to go directly to Casey's readings about it. Sometimes the shorthand on it is Firestone. But Firestone actually represents kind of small mini stations of this main power station, which was a gigantic crystal that, you know, I saw recently a retired NASA scientist took a crack at it. And what it looks like, based on the Casey description, is a gigantic tower. And these power stations had to do a lot with the way that the sun came through that crystal, that they could do things like fly planes. and they could do things like power their cities and all the rest of it using these crystals. Now, what's going to be interesting is in the second part of this understanding, we're going to understand that it wasn't just high tech for the pleasure vehicles or for getting your city going or the way that we use it. They would use the tech for spiritual communication with the higher realms. This is the crucial aspect and how it relates to why these groups are bringing it up and how it relates later to what we call the X-steganography and things like the UFO file. And it has nothing to do at this juncture. Any of this has nothing to do with like ancient aliens, for example. You know, those things come into play when we look at our ancient history, but the X-steganography referring to the UFO file in the 20th century and what the mystery schools are referring to, this is an ongoing mystery about our interaction with these unseen realms, and the effect that is achieved when we have that interaction is something that I've called apotheum, because it's really the effect, that reality distortion effect and the upsetting of the paradigm of reality, including the laws that govern the physical reality, that these mystery schools have tried to hide and keep secret over this time. So let's get into Casey's description of the Firestone real briefly. Here we go. This was a reading given in 1934, and it's basically people asking him, hey, you've talked about Atlantis in these past life readings. What is it? Quote, it's Casey reading. Before that, we find the entity, which is the person who's come from the reading, was in the Atlantean land when there were the preparations for those things that had pertained to the ability for the application of various elements known as electrical forces in the present day. As to the manners and ways in which the various crafts carried individuals from place to place and what may be known in the present as the photographing from a distance. And he talks a lot about the Atlanteans using photography and also photographing through things. So kind of X-ray photography. The fields of activity that show the ability for reading inscriptions through walls, even at a distance. Or for the preparations for the elevations and the various activities where there was the overcoming of, as termed today, the forces of nature or gravity itself. And the preparations and the preparations through the crystal, the mighty, and then all in caps, the terrible crystal. And he finishes off by saying that made for the active principles in these and were a portion of the entity's activity in that experience. Over and over again, when Casey talks about the crystal, it is the mighty, terrible crystal. The two-eye stone is something that's remembered as devastating. So I guess the equivalent would be, you know, we develop this kind of nuclear technology and we have these bombs and all the rest of it, but it's fueling our cities and we do all those things. And then at some point, that nuclear energy gets used and it devastates an entire continent. And then we look back on it and we say, remember all the hopes we had about this incredible energy source and how it just completely destroyed our country. That's a very real scenario that we face every day when we get involved in these nuclear situations. And certainly that's something that would be familiar to us. When he's talking about the crystal and he's going back and looking at the records of this individual and something called the Akashic Record, which is a principle that comes up a lot in these mystery schools where they have people who can achieve these different states, go into these states and read these records. So in that record, in this case, is the mighty, terrible crystal. So it's not thought of as this wonderful thing. It's a terrible thing that destroyed a continent. So this guy who's an engineer, actually, in this lifetime, and he's come back. He was an engineer in Atlantis also. So he asked the question, what was the two-eye stone? And that's T-U-A-O-I. Okay, that's the way Casey spelt it. It's an unusual word, and I've tried to find the real true definition and origin of the word, and it's a tricky one, T-U-A-O-I. So the person asks, what was the shape or form that it had? And Casey answers, it was in the form of a six-sided figure, in which the light appeared as the means of communication between infinity and the finite, or the means whereby there were the communications with those forces from the outside. Later, this came to mean that from which the energy is radiated, as of the various forms or transitions of travel through which those periods of activity of the Atlanteans. Now, what's interesting about the Atlanteans here is the way he's describing the crystal in the beginning is it's used to communicate with, it's like a spiritual interface. It's spiritual technology. It's an actual device where we can interact with the spiritual realm, the higher realm in this case. So they're dealing directly with these higher entities through this crystal. And as he goes along in these different readings, and there's so many readings around the Firestone, but I'm going to summarize some of them, which is the idea that they have these priestesses who come forward and they are kind of purified and raised around these principles. And they have incredible telepathic abilities. And they are people who come forward to use the crystal. So they're trained their whole lives to be able to use this thing. Because, of course, if it has the kind of power to devastate a continent and take it out, it also has, you know, it has to be dealt with very carefully. So even though you're communicating with these higher spiritual realms, if you don't do it right, it could be personally dangerous. So you have to be trained after a kind of pattern that's been handed down over time. And this is the development of Atlantis. So the Two-Eye Stone, there's a period where these groups develop in Atlantis, and one of the groups is called the Law of One, the followers of the Law of One. And by the way, there are groups that channel the Law of One and all the rest of it. And, there's a lot of different things along that line, but the Law of One, this basically has nothing to do with that. This is just Casey looking back and seeing who these followers were. So that doesn't relate anything to those movements, good or bad. Okay, so the other group is called the Belial Group. And this is also a weird name, but of course we have Baal in the Bible, and we have these kind of references to this, kind of evil offshoot. But I think that we, when we really look at the Belial split with the Children of the Law of One, I think what we're looking at is the Law of One group is using the technology to interface with higher realms. They're getting spiritual information and growing that way. And they have a group of initiates running it. The Belial people are a growing faction who want to use the technology to kind of dominate nature. And boy, we see a lot of that now. But what happens is a split develops, because while they're doing that and using the technology for these reasons that are more materially applicable, they're also starting to push into other territories and kind of use it in a militaristic fashion. So the Belial group really is something I think we have as a legacy that we're dealing with now big time. And they, for me, tie in directly with Steiner's nemesis, Ahriman, which I didn't show earlier. That is Ahriman. That's a sculpture, actually, that Steiner did himself. Shows you how talented he was. But this is after a deep meditation, and he got this impression after working on the idea of Ahriman for years of what he actually appeared as. And it's a pretty menacing, very kind of occult figure. But that for Steiner's money, that's the face of Ahriman. Okay, so let's get into Casey talking a little bit about what Belial does with the high technology of Atlantis. And this is again from directly from the Casey readings. Quote, "The use of these influences by the sons of Belial brought them the first of the upheavals, or the turning of the etheric rays." This is going to be a very important term for us to keep in mind, because the etheric rays will come up again in Theosophy years later, talking about the technology that they needed, a John Keeley technology that they needed to keep hidden. So he says, "The first of the upheavals, or the tuning of the etheric rays influence from the sun, as used by the followers of the Law of One, into the facet for the activities of same, produced what we would call a volcanic upheaval and the separating of the land into several islands." Now, the islands become called Posidia, Arion, and Og. And Posidia, which is near Bimini and that whole area where Cuba is by Florida, became the most powerful. And it's the Atlantis of record. That's the one that's really remembered in history. It was the dominant portion, you know. So you could say really it's like the major city of the continent, but it splits it into three islands. So what we have happening here, according to Casey, is interesting. The Belial group, in using the technology, basically, the followers of the Law of One developed this light technology working with this crystal, and they are able to communicate with spiritual realms. The Belial group understands that they can use it to dominate the physical world, but they get sloppy with it also. And what happens is they set off volcanic activity, and that splits up the entire continent. That's the first major split that happens in Atlantis. There are many more to come. The ones that we get to know so well are through Plato and all the rest of it. That's really the end. That's the very end, where they're not even anything like what they used to be. And I do think it's important to point out that when we're talking about Steiner and Casey, both of them, and also Theosophy, they go right to Atlantis as the real kind of setup for the situation and the theme of time that we're in. And they all imply that the Atlanteans who were in that period are reincarnating into that next century with all this high-tech stuff and facing the same situation that they did back then and hopefully doing something better with it this time. So this idea that they split off the islands is important, and Poseidon is going to become very important to understanding Casey's version of what happened back there. So let's keep following this. Back to Casey. For this entity, then, in the center, upon a board or paper, we would begin with the stone as the light of the activities in the temple in the Atlantean Poseidon era. This might be termed the Tuai stone, T-U-A-O-I. This would be a six-facet stone of the height as to proportion with the rest of the chart as may be indicated. The stone of the Tuai would be opalescent, while the light would be indicated from the top in the rays of the white light. So the group that is running this, followers of the Law of One, are the foundation group who will be the Great White Brotherhood. They are these advanced adepts in Atlantis. And the Great White Brotherhood, they're kind of like the guardians of humanity. And the mystery schools are always referencing them as, you know, that's where we get so many things in our higher knowledge. And a lot of the groups, even that were involved with founding the United States, and the Masonic groups and the individuals like George Washington and Franklin who are associated with them, they're aware of this legacy that's been left by these brotherhoods. And the Great White Brotherhood has many lesser schools also. But to understand that this started back there with these high adepts using this Atlantean technology, and then the groups from Belial coming in and destroying it, basically, and destroying the influence of the crystal. Now, Steiner, when he looks back at this period, he says there are many things he can't even reveal, and he's being stopped when he's reading the Akashic account, because the dark sorcerers involved with Atlantis in that period of time had such abilities and such powers that referencing what they did with it might be a kind of secret to reanimating that mess and bringing this back, which is fascinating because I had a conversation with Joseph Farrell, and we bring this up sometimes in our interviews, about archaeology wars where countries go into these different countries like Iraq and in Africa looking for some of this older technology. And trust me, that's a real thing, archaeology wars. There's a lot of things that support the idea that they are looking for a lot of these ancient artifacts that caused the problem in the first place. And when you think about the title of Farrell's books, like Giza Death Star, the whole book series that he has, it's based on the idea of a lot of that a lot of those Egyptian buildings and Sumerian buildings being weapons centers. So we see here the misuse there by these Belial groups of that kind of technology. So I think we're getting an idea for it. I want an even more precise description of the stone for the really engineering-minded out there. So indulge me for a moment. It was a period when there was much that has not even been thought of yet in the present experience, speaking in the 1930s. So he's saying the Atlanteans are so advanced that to describe it would be difficult using 1930s language. About the Firestone that was in the experience, did the activities of the entity then make those applications that dealt with both the constructive and destructive forces in the period? It would be well that there be given something of a description of this, that it may be better understood by the entity in the present as to how both constructive and destructive forces were generated by the activity of the stone. And we are setting that up by saying the Atlanteans are using it, the Law of One group is using it for these higher interactions with spiritual beings. The Belial group is using it to blast away at their enemies. So the description of the stone. In the center of a building that today would be said to have been lined with non-conductive metals or non-conductive stone, something akin to asbestos. The building above the stone was oval or a dome, wherein there could be or was the rolling back so that the activities of the stone was received from the sun's rays or from the stars, the concentrating of the energies that emanate from the bodies that are on fire themselves, saying these stars are on fire, and that's what the crystal is capturing. So it's capturing the sun's rays, and it's capturing these stars. So I'm going to skip down a little bit. The concentration through the prisms, or glass, as would be called in the present, was in such a manner that it acted upon the instruments that were connected to the various modes of travel, a power station. Through induction methods that made much the character of control as the remote control through radio vibrations or directions would be in the present day. Though the manner of the force that was impelled from the stone acted upon the motivating forces of the crafts themselves, there was the preparation so that when the dome was rolled back, there might be little or no hindrance in the application direct to the various crafts that were to be impelled through space, whether in the radius of the visioning of one eye, as it might be called, or whether directed underwater or under other elements or through other elements. Now, this is remarkable because what he's saying is this power station could send things out into space. It could, you know, send flying vehicles out there. It can send these airships. It can power the airships around the Earth. It can power submarines, and it can empower a kind of cloaking ability where these ships can go through things. That's pretty advanced. You know, we have stealth technology. We know that we have pretty advanced stuff. These guys, definitely, from his description, this is what they had. So just to kind of round out the idea of Belial misusing this high-end technology, let's get a snapshot of what these mystery schools might be hiding and why the X-steganography was adopted in the first place. Through the same form of fire, the bodies of individuals were regenerated by the burning through the application of the rays from the stone, the influences that brought destructive forces to an animal organism. Hence, the body rejuvenated itself often. This is why they lived so long. You know, we have those strange references in the early parts of the Bible. It's like, you know, well, he lived 2,000 years, then he moved on. There's an interesting thing. It's like an echo back there of these people aging and then going and being regenerated and coming back in the same lifetime. So this kind of fountain of youth idea has been an echo in many mythical systems. But according to Casey, they had very advanced high-tech machines that were doing it with radiation. And, you know, when we hear about things like life extension technologies now, wow, you know, we're going into that same realm. So, hence, the body rejuvenated itself often and remained in that land until the eventual destruction of Poseidia, because Poseidia went down also. Now, he says here, you joined with the people that made for the breaking up of the land, or you joined with Belial. at the final destruction of the land. And in this, you lost. At first, it was not the intention nor the desire for destructive forces. Later, it was for the ascension of power itself. So he's speaking to this person about their past life and what they did there in Atlantis, but we're getting a whole other panorama of this Belial group basically taking everyone down by abusing the technology involved, which is going to become incredibly important when we get to Steiner and Ahriman. So bear with me. As to as to the final destruction of the land. So he says, the manner of construction of the stone, we find it was a large cylindrical glass, as would be termed today, cut with facets in such a manner that the capstone on top of same made for the centralizing of the power or force that concentrated between the end of the cylinder and the capstone itself. So they have these stations utilizing these crystals that are pulling down solar energy and energy from the stars, and they're able to do these incredible things with them. So speaking of archaeology wars, Casey references that some of the smaller versions, you know, what happened, the way we walk around with a smartphone now, Casey says that the Firestones are almost like miniature versions of the Firestones, or something that groups would use. So you had the incredible power stations and then these little tiny local ones. And so he refers to a very unusual incident about how these Firestones will be discovered again. And it has to do with a group that is at the University of Pennsylvania sending out an expedition. And here's where things get a little bit interesting. So he says, now in Yucatan, in America, 1932, these Firestones that they know so little about are being uncovered during the last few months. So right there in 1932. So the Firestones at the museum, and he identifies the Pennsylvania Museum as where the Firestones were. So years later, people went looking for this stuff. So much so that there's a large article statement by the museum still on their website that I was reading that said, Casey's Firestones aren't here. But they were there in 1932, according to Casey. So let's see how this even happened. So there's a character named Iltar who's leaving Poseidia during the destruction. He comes to Yucatan and he sets up a temple there, and he kind of recreates the Atlantean civilization. And he is burying records there, like the Hall of Records that are in Egypt under the Sphinx. And they contain a whole history of Atlantis and all the rest of it. So Casey says, quote, the first temples erected by Iltar and his followers were destroyed at the period of change in the contours of the land. Those of that first civilization following have been discovered in Yucatan, but have not yet been opened. We might have this evidence of Atlantis if we could only understand the significance of the unique stones discovered in Yucatan back in 1933. Casey had apparently foreseen the archaeological activity that would turn up some relic of the gigantic Firestones. So Jess Stern wrote a book about Casey in the 60s called The Sleeping Prophet. And he went deep into this, trying to figure out what happened with the stones. And it's pretty unusual, because Casey outlines a formula about how to find them. He says parts of the stones, you know, it was set up by the Pennsylvania Museum, but when they come back, it goes half to the Chicago Museum and half to Pennsylvania. So there's this whole thing around it. So he says, let's clarify this, for the pattern may be more easily found, for these pattern stones will be brought to the United States. A portion is to be carried to the Pennsylvania State Museum. A portion is to be carried to the Washington Museum or to Chicago. Now, there's a Fate magazine report from 1962 that says three elaborate sealed Mayan tombs over 2,000 years old have been discovered by University of Pennsylvania Museum archaeologists on the Yucatan Peninsula of Guatemala. So when I talk about stealth archives, it's very interesting because the Hall of Records is also a stealth archive, and the Firestones now and the archaeological dig where they brought them to this museum is another one. And let me briefly describe a stealth archive. A stealth archive is something that we know is there, we know has a secret, but it's something we can't get our hands on. So the letter in the LBJ library, that's a letter X. Everyone knows it's there. Scholars know it's there. It's not someone's conspiracy theory. You can even pull up a picture of it online, and I've shown it many times on the show. That's to be opened in 2023. So the very definition of stealth archive is going to help us here, because we know that that's there and we can't get our hands on it. You know, and I've shown many different examples of this, like the Project X time capsule from Eisenhower. We know about these archives. So for people who understand what they mean, it's there in the public, but they're stealth archives for us. We don't have the access to them. Now, the Hall of Records is very much like this, because Casey said, well, the Atlanteans put all their information about their civilization and all these things about the Two-Eye Stone in a passage under the Sphinx. And we all know these different things about people try to get licenses to dig there and all the rest of it. So you and I know about this Hall of Records through the Casey readings. And people have spent all this time trying to figure out what that was all about. And the Egyptian authorities have kind of shoved them away and probably have gone looking for it themselves. But it's interesting, because that's the ultimate stealth archive. So this little bit of archaeological information is fascinating, because if there are groups who, and very much we see the Rockefellers, for example, sponsoring these different expeditions and different types of research, if there are groups that are concerned, like Joseph Farrell says, with finding many of these artifacts relating to the ancient technology so they can use them as an advantage now, it's very dangerous stuff, because back then it wiped out a continent and maybe more. So the Firestones, though, and the rediscovery of these Firestones is something that Casey is saying, hey, you know, this is where the expedition was. They don't even know what they mean yet. But I think that this is something that we need to keep in mind if we're going to have a real picture of what's happening. When we see things like the looting of the Baghdad Museum during the Iraq War, it is an extra register about what we're doing there and what it's all about. And there are these kind of suggestions now that so many of those different tablets are going back into the Baghdad Museum. And in fact, at the Baghdad Museum, it turned out many scholars had been looking at trying to get access to these tablets when Saddam Hussein was there. Well, they couldn't. But guess what? Now, when they go back there, they're not going to have access to those tablets either. So we see this game kind of gets played in this regard, but I do think it's fascinating. So I think we have an idea about what Casey is suggesting in terms of the power of the Firestones and how they have this amazing ability to power ships and do all these positive things and have this incredible kind of spiritual connection with higher beings through the technology, or be used to devastate other continents and blow up yourself. So this is apparently what is so dangerous about them. Let's say that. And there's more information there, but I'm going to move on directly to Steiner's stuff. But one final thing I want to say about the crystal is Casey's actual description of how it destroyed Atlantis. What he says is, these forces and the influences of the radiation arose in the form of rays that were invisible to the eye, but acted upon the stones themselves. These forces were not intentionally tuned too high and brought the second period of destructive forces and broke up the land into isles, where later there were further destructive forces that destroyed Atlantis. So we're getting the full picture there of what happened. It was a massive destruction. And Casey's version of it is probably the most advanced. I have to say that Theosophy deals with it and Steiner deals with Atlantis. But when we look at Casey's version of Atlantis, Edgar Casey on Atlantis is probably one of the best books dealing with it. And now, before we go any further into Ahriman and the Eighth Sphere, which is the next place that we're going, which is really where the X takes us, I'm going to check in with Olivia.
Mm-hmm. How you doing?
How's it going over there?
Fantastic chat. I'm riveted.
Great. Well, we have a lot of great people out there. It's nice to see so many people coming out. Because that Saturday night is always a gamble. But I do want to say that, you know, of course, what you want to do is ask your questions now, because in the second part of the program, we're going to take questions. And so those questions for Olivia. And a reminder to go to darkjournalist.com and sign up for the newsletter, so we have that kind of back and forth going on. And if you want, Olivia, while I am digging up the Aramon section, why don't you tell me about the questions we have going on?
Well, there are some great questions, but just great discussions. A fantastic group of people here tonight. Would you want a question right now?
Sure. Well, I mean, related to the topic, yes.
Absolutely. Well, I'll just throw this one out. CJ wanted to know, is Antarctica really Atlantis under all the ice? What have they discovered down there?
Wow. Well, we know that the Pyrrho Reis map shows Antarctica as a normal continent with no ice on it. And those ancient maps, we really do get a sense that whatever happened, there was a pole shift back there. And some of the really incredible people like Graham Hancock and others have studied this. And they come to the same conclusion, which is that something happened, and it happened almost overnight, where, you know, Casey calls it a pole shift that took place in 50,000 BC, and others have traced it to a more recent period. But something happened there, and so that if there was a thriving culture going on in Antarctica, it would be something that would be completely hidden under that ice, just like Atlantis is hidden under the water. So, of course, there's more than one advanced civilization, and we know that Lemuria was another one in the Pacific that also went under when all this took place. But it really is like imagining the leaders of the world, like America, for example, just being devastated by upheavals and, you know, the landmass splitting. And then over time, just, you know, it becoming a situation where the people had to flee and there was a massive migration problem. This is really what we're talking about and what we're looking at. The last thing that I want to mention in relation to Casey here is we're going to kick into what he says about the Great White Brotherhood and their relation to storing the knowledge after the Atlantean devastation. So he refers to them as Hermes and Ra, those that took up the work of Ararat, and there began the building of what is now called Giza. This is 10,500 BC that he's saying the structure called Giza is set up. And, you know, it's interesting because one of the interesting things that Casey points out, and I always find this fascinating, which is that they chose the spot where they have the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx because they were doing archaeology. So this is 10,500 BC, and there's no question that popular archaeology dates the Sphinx and the pyramid to 2,500 BC in that neck of the woods. So this is 8,000 years earlier that Casey pinpoints it. So it's a much older structure. But he's saying even with that, even with those 8,000 years, that that is the spot they chose because they were doing archaeology of something even older. So who put that there? You know, this becomes a very fascinating and intriguing thing about what is the Giza complex all about. So he says, with Hermes and Ra, there began the beginning of the building of what is now called Giza, and with which those prophecies that had been in the Temple of Records and the Temple Beautiful went into the building of this pyramid that was to be the hall of the initiates of that sometimes referred to as the Great White Brotherhood. So it became the Hall of the Initiates. That is, they would go through the pyramid in order, just like in Atlantis when they had these spiritual ceremonies with the crystal. But it no longer was available to the public or this group, the Sons of Belial, that had caused the destruction in Atlantis. These brotherhoods were going to preserve it among themselves. They were going to trade this information inside. It was an inside situation now. This is the beginning of some pretty heavy-duty secrecy that will go down. And I think when we look at that, we're looking at something that's very strange about the pyramid too. And I want to insert this as a kind of a side thought, but Casey said that the pyramid predicts everything going forward from when it was built. So when they asked him, well, how could it be, you know, and he said, well, it's in the measurements. It's in the type of stone used. It's in the angles, even. There's a kind of steganography there that we can read. And they said, well, how specific is it in terms of things that are going to happen? And he said, it actually pinpoints the names of individuals and the streets they grew up on. So this is quite an incredible layout, you know, to know all these things in advance. And it gives you some of that whole argument about predestination there, that they were able to pinpoint these things 10,500 years ago about you and I and the streets that we grew up on. Very, very interesting. Steiner in Anthroposophy, talking about in the same period and even a little bit before with Theosophy, talking about Atlantis, talking about the airships, talking about the advanced civilization that split into many islands, and talking about its destruction and how it was remembered, and also cutting off a lot of dialogue, that is, not revealing certain things about just how bad the groups that got in charge of Atlantis were, which I think is pretty fascinating. But Steiner puts it in, it was a crucial period where mankind had to be given godlike abilities very early on, and also that we weren't so tightly knit in matter. So there was a kind of a looser situation in terms of we were more etheric bodies and became more and more physical as time moved on. And we're moving into a period now where we're reacquiring the technology and the ability to be as gods as we had in that period. Last time it didn't turn out so well. That's the basic message. So I think we got a real good idea of Casey's version of Atlantis there and the power of the Two-Eye Stone, which is something that we're going to go into further in the X episodes. But let's go to Steiner and his version of Ahriman, because I think this is absolutely crucial. Ahriman is a kind of archon, which is he's a lord of a lower astral realm, and he's connected to the evolution of the earth, as many of these dark forces are. Now, what's going on, according to Steiner, is there are forces that are opposed to humanity's development and their evolution. And at the head of that ticket is Ahriman, who is the traditional Bible devil. But there are names and there are attributions to other things that mix up Ahriman with other traditions and mix up the devil with other traditions. And some of this is done on purpose. But in any case, he chooses the name Ahriman to give us an idea of what that force is that is opposed to us. But what's fascinating is the battle and the way that he sees it framed is not so much that the good side, the Great White Brotherhood, needs to destroy Ahriman. It's a little bit different. What happens is the Great White Brotherhood needs to train humanity in order to apprehend from Ahriman the things that he has. This is very interesting and kind of goes deep into what the philosophy around Anthroposophy is, but it is about facing up to that challenge and then winning over using the abilities of the thing that you face and move on from. So in a way, humanity has to face Ahriman, which is the ultimate shadow in a sense, and these kind of archonic forces, because in doing that, will it attain the ability to evolve? But if we don't do it, we're going to be locked in a cycle of being chained to the Earth's evolution. And the Earth's evolution is only one aspect of what we're evolving. And if you go into deep with Steiner and Anthroposophy, the Earth's evolution is all about setting up the evolution of Jupiter and so on. That human wave moves on. So for our purposes, what we need to do is get a handle on what it is, what are the deep forces that the mystery schools can see that we can't get a handle on in everyday life. And what's happening is the mystery schools, by letting out information through Steiner, by letting out information through Casey, are giving us the tools to do battle and to apprehend reality as it is. And I think that when I review Steiner's information, and when he's writing in 1916 here, and he says, if anthroposophy fails now, it'll get a chance in 100 years. Well, we're in that zone that he's talking about, and he felt that anthroposophy had failed along with theosophy in the period, because when World War I happened, he decided, you know, for all the things that we were working on, you know, this just hasn't spread fast enough. So in 100 years, it'll get another chance. But another very, very interesting thing that he did is, and this is one of his most important books called Cosmic Memory. I highly recommend that book, along with An Outline of Occult Science and Knowledge of Higher Worlds. Those are really his incredible canon. But one of the interesting side things that he did was he let out all these lectures that had been previously secret and only for members of anthroposophy, and usually the higher members. But he got so disgusted with the conditions of humanity during World War I that he was like, you know, everything needs to go out. People need to wake up. We're going to let it out. So even if it's not edited well, or if the lectures aren't taken down well, just move that stuff out. Even if it's a secret, a big secret, get it moving. So he did that, and this is where we get so much of the Ahriman information, which is included in the books, but not in the detail that we get in the lectures. So Ahriman is this figure that's opposed to humanity's evolution. And what he's done in Steiner's outline is create something called the Eighth Sphere. In Steiner's outline, we move through these planets in a kind of reincarnation chain. We learn things from the different planets, and we come back to Earth and apply the lessons. What's going on with Ahriman is he is glamorizing humanity so that it moves into his version of evolution, which is this Eighth Sphere evolution, where we don't get to evolve and move the situation. We get chained to the Earth's evolution. And what happens is humanity becomes more and more the pawn of Ahriman and doesn't reach its own spiritual heights. And so it's a very dangerous situation, the way that he puts it. So I'm going to pull a few quotes from Steiner to get an idea of what we're up against in dealing with this, because it really goes to the heart of what the mystery schools are doing using the X as a symbol. So what he says is, quote, today the spirit soul is asleep. The human being is thus in danger of drifting into the Ahrimanic world, in which case the spirit soul will evaporate into the cosmos eventually. So through fantasies, through material desires, through daydreams, we are drifting into a kind of illusionary world, not doing the things that we're here to do. You know, getting caught up. I was talking about 2 minutes hate. That's very Ahrimanic kind of stuff. The type of stuff we see on Fox News or MSNBC when they're really pushing you to hate a country or hate a political figure puts you into an Ahrimanic state. And it basically leaves you at the mercy of these forces, which are creating an environment for you to identify with and get stuck in, which is basically, you know, under their power. I guess that would be the great way to describe it. So he's literally saying that the stakes are your soul evaporates into the cosmos. Not a very good state of affairs. Quote, we live in a time when people face the danger of losing their souls to materialistic impulses. This is a very serious matter. We now stand confronted with this fact. So in Steiner's version, Ahriman is the enemy of mankind, and mankind overcomes him by facing him. So let's get a little deeper into what he means by that as we go along here. This is fascinating. This one, when I was reading it, it's from 1916, but it could have been written yesterday by one of us studying the economic situation or the deep state or the black budget. But this is Steiner speaking in these kind of cosmic terms in a very practical fashion. Observe. I call this section Ahriman Deep State. Do you like that one, Olivia?
You bet.
If we inquire who stirs up nations against each other, who raises the questions that are directing humanity today? The answer is the Armonic deception, which plays into human life. And in this field, men very easily let themselves be deceived. They're not willing to descend to the lower strata where reality is to be found. For you see, Ahriman skillfully prepares his goal beforehand. Ever since the Reformation and the Renaissance, the economist has been emerging in modern civilization as the representative governing type. Wow. Here's the corporate overlords coming on strong. And this is 1916, remember? The economist has been emerging in modern civilization as the representative governing type. Thus, Ahriman has been given another essential medium for the deception of mankind. If men do not realize that the rights, state, and the organism of the spirit must be set against the economic order called up through the economists and the banks, then again, through this lack of awareness, Ahriman will find an important instrument for preparing his incarnation. His incarnation is undoubtedly coming, and this lack of insight will enable him to prepare it triumphantly. Now, in order that his incarnation may take the most profitable form, it is of the utmost interest to Ahriman that people should perfect themselves in all illusory modern science, but without knowing that it is an illusion. So what he's saying here is the more mechanistic the society becomes, and the more that we have these kind of economic overlords, and the more our consciousness dims into this kind of robotic, automatic society that's based on automation, the less we're using our brains, the less we're using our spirit power. We're getting overpowered by this force that is sweeping in and preparing its own incarnation. And, you know, we think of that as a physical incarnation. But when I think about things like D-Wave, which is something that Elena Freeland told me about it, it's this really kind of incredible supercomputer. And I won't go deep into this, but I will say this, that she told me that one of the things that's required for the D-Wave chip is that it needs to be in a storage container that's colder than space. And when I think about the incarnation of Ahriman, and I think about things that Steiner has said about how he's slowing down the evolution of humanity. And at one point, he talks about Steiner turning the world into a gigantic, he talks about Ahriman turning the world into a gigantic deep freeze. That is, everything becomes hard and heavy like granite. I think very much about this D-Wave chip and the incarnation of AI coming through directly. And that's why I think that the key is with Ahriman and what Steiner is saying. In 100 years, you'll understand this information a little better. Here we are. I think we do. We're starting to understand it a little better. But still, this is incredibly modern for 1916, but let's carry on. His incarnation is undoubtedly coming, and this lack of insight will enable him to prepare it triumphantly. Now, in order that his incarnation may take the most profitable form, it is of the utmost interest to Ahriman that people should perfect themselves in all illusory modern science, but without knowing that it's an illusion. Ahriman has the greatest possible interest in instructing men in mathematics, but not in instructing them that mathematical mechanistic concepts of the universe are merely illusions. And he goes deep into this. This section, lecture, is called The Ahrimanic Deception. And the other book is Ahriman and Lucifer, which I highly recommend people get. There's differentiation here, which Steiner takes a lot of issue with materialistic, scientific materialism and how it plunged us into this, the lowest possible state of mind where the spirit gets completely disconnected and we become kind of part of a system of these kind of earthbound rational facts that don't allow for the larger picture of our actual soul body and reality. And from that position, we lose many of our abilities. And so we also become basically more of a sitting duck for these forces to sweep in and control us. That is what he's referring to. So there's a piece here about Steiner and Atlantis that I'm going to move along to, because I want to get really to the heart of Ahriman. And he does talk about Ahriman and his hosts. So it's a whole gigantic spirit movement that is moving through. So we hear so many things about, you know, these different types of groups of archons and things like that. And what's a good archon, what's a bad archon. It is very fascinating. I have to say that for me, what we want to do is, because people can kind of plug into all different types of evil influences, and we know people who get very deep on the religious side can look at everything as not religious, for example. I don't want to suggest that that's a positive direction. What I want to do is lift up the idea that we can become aware of spiritual forces that are not working in our best interest, and how they may have a big play in society right now when we see this large-scale move towards robotics and automation, that there's a spiritual thrust behind it that we need to understand. And if we do, then everything changes, because suddenly, you know, it's like when you wake up out of a dream, you have the power all of a sudden. Now, another thing that he has to say here is that Ahriman works in countless ways, infinitely diverse ways upon man. I told you that the event of the mystery of Golgotha was a moment of supreme importance for the evolution of the world. This is the crucifixion of Christ. The Christ appeared in the realm into which man enters after death, where Ahriman's influence was even mightier than in the world around man here on earth between birth and death. In the realm of existence between death and rebirth, Ahriman's influences worked upon man with their terrible, overwhelming power. And if nothing else had taken place, utter darkness would gradually have closed in upon man, a realm of shades. But instead, the Golgotha incident changed the evolution of the earth and shook Ahriman's power. Although Ahriman's influence remained and is really the origin of all materialistic thinking on the part of man, all materialistic thinking, that's a pretty big way to put it. Although this influence can be paralyzed only if men receive into themselves the power emanating from the mystery of Golgotha. Nevertheless, they can draw from the event a power which enables them to find their way once again into the divine spiritual world. And that gets very deep. I do understand that, you know, we're dealing with religious subjects and spiritual subjects and cosmic subjects, but basically what he's saying is that Ahriman has a kind of a power base here, and that these movements by things like the Great White Brotherhood have shaken up his power and have made the transition smooth for people coming through the world to move on to a spiritual center. But Ahriman's power is growing, and that the moment that humanity now has built up has had 2,000, 3,000 years of these mystery schools working the information, we are kind of facing up to this point where we're going to have to confront Ahriman. And the people who were working on the mystery school side of theosophy and things along that line came to the conclusion that it would be better to come from a Buddhist perspective. And the Steiner push for anthroposophy and the Casey work and Rosicrucian work and things of this nature are coming from a Western initiate side, saying, no, the Buddhists and the Eastern traditions set us up so that the Western tradition could take all of their work and then move it up. It's the Western tradition's time to establish itself and take all the lessons that we gained from the East 3,000 years ago. So this was the nature of the battle between the mystery schools coming out and deciding what should we do with this information and who should be in charge of it. I think what's happened is, over 100 years, that opportunity has come up again, where anthroposophy waited 100 years, the theosophical ideas are coming into play again, and we have a better idea from looking back at what they accomplished over that period of time to see which group was correct. But anyway, let's move on. The Ahriman and Lucifer, this is something that we'll go a little bit deeper into next time. But the eighth sphere is a crucial thing for us to understand, because especially now when we have all this glamorization, when we have all the phones and we have the nonstop television and video streaming through the phones, mostly of content that's lowering our consciousness, there's a kind of a slipping away into a fantasy world of social media and all these other things, although they certainly have their benefits. But the risk is facing this stuff without any kind of spiritual knowledge, without any foundations in the battles that are taking place in the unseen realms. So let's take a quick look at Steiner's version of the eighth sphere here, and then we'll go into your questions. Besides these, there is an eighth sphere to which everything goes that cannot make any connection with this continuous evolution of Earth. When a human being uses the life on Earth only to amass what is of service to himself alone, only to experience an intensification of his own egotistical self, this leads to Devakan. This leads in Devakan, heaven, into a condition of Avicii, a person who cannot escape from his own separateness. All these Avicii men will eventually become inhabitants of the eighth sphere. The other human beings will be inhabitants of the continuing chain of evolution. It is from this concept that religions have formulated the doctrine of hell. Now, this is absolutely fascinating because basically by becoming bedazzled, people run the risk. Aspects of humanity, maybe the large majority of humanity, run the risk of moving into this eighth sphere version of evolution. And Steiner and the anthroposophical movement is about training humanity to face off against Ahriman, to keep on the normal evolutionary track of higher spiritual development. This is what the heart of the mystery school battle is about. And the technological aspects around the Ahrimanic teaching that Steiner is giving out are basically vouchsafed here 100 years ago for us to use now. And this is what, in looking at it and looking at these connections of the mystery schools and why they told us so many things, why we got to understand about things like Atlantis and reincarnation and why they were coming out with this information and giving it freely to the public after holding it back for so many years, is that in Steiner's words, the period had come where we needed it, or else we were going to become puppets of scientific materialism, and scientific materialism being the realm of the power of these Ahrimanic forces. That's what transhumanism is all about. It's a crucial aspect. It's a crucial revelation for us. So let's just wrap up with a couple of Steiner quotes about the eighth sphere. The destination to which I refer is known as the eighth sphere, which is a quasi-spiritual world which permeates the earth. Steiner says, thus, as sphere three was advancing to a further stage, there are different spheres that have come up, something has wrested away from the spirits of form by Lucifer and Ahriman. Into this part that is wrested away, Lucifer and Ahriman penetrate. Instead of the spirits of form, the activities of Ahriman are added to the spirits of movement. Steiner goes deeper into this description. The most manifold process occurs with this mist-like element. So what's happening is he's describing this period after death when we are moving from the earthly realms into these other realms. But I'm actually, because that's a little bit dense, I'm going to skip to this, which is kind of like the capsulization quote of the whole thing. Lucifer and Ahriman strive unceasingly to draw from the earth's substances whatever they can snatch in order to form their eighth sphere, which, when it is sufficiently advanced, will be detached from the earth and go its own way in the cosmos together with Lucifer and Ahriman. It's a direct quote from Steiner. This alchemy by which mineral substance is sent over into the eighth sphere is taking place all the time behind the scenes of our existence. So what happened, and it's very kind of fascinating, is that as he brought this up, a strange teaching came up about the eighth sphere from A.P. Sinnott, who was a theosophist. And he had been kind of bedazzled, and sort of the wrong information came out. So the whole move to understand this eighth sphere activity through Steiner got distorted through the actions of Sinnott, and he came out against what Sinnott said. But a few final quotes here about the eighth sphere from Steiner. The endeavor of Lucifer and Ahriman is to drag the free will of man and whatever stems from it into the eighth sphere. This means that man is perpetually exposed to the danger of having his free will wrested from him and dragged by Lucifer and Ahriman into the eighth sphere. This happens if the element of free will is transformed, for example, into visionary clairvoyance. When this is the case, a man is already in the eighth sphere. This is a matter of which occultists are reluctant to speak on because it is an awful, terrible truth. Lucifer and Ahriman are engaged perpetually in shackling man's free will and in conjuring all sorts of things before him in order to tear away what he makes out of these things and let it disappear into the eighth sphere. So my final translation on that for all of us is basically this. The thing that's been set up is not a normal track of evolution. You know, so the way that Anthroposophy sees it, we have a normal track of evolution where we reincarnate by going through these different planetary sojourns and come back here and apply the lessons and then master the system and move on. That also comes up in the Casey readings. The Ahrimanic forces need, because they're such masters of this realm, they need humanity basically to stay on this level and lower so that they can maintain control over that soul wave. This is their main function. And it seems to me that the main reason the mystery schools are letting this information out is because they realize that there's going to be kind of a showdown on that level where you have groups like the Great White Brotherhood putting this information out and you have Ahriman sweeping in with the technology. And somewhere between the two is humanity fighting to get a handle on what's going on in their world, in their evolution, and in their spiritual life. So when people shut that aspect out and they say, well, I'm not, you know, living for my spiritual life or whatever, and they make themselves the plaything of material living, then it goes in, according to Steiner's work, that you become kind of a plaything for those occult forces. You're playing into that system where your life and your evolutionary track go into this eighth sphere activity, because there's a kind of bedazzling that takes place in the material realms, which when we're looking at Eastern traditions, they call it Maya. And the illusions that get conjured up are to take away humanity's soul. Well, what Steiner is giving us, instead of just the flowery language of, you know, taking away men's souls into illusion, he's saying, here's the mechanics. There's an actual eighth sphere set up the same way that the evolutionary track is set up here on Earth. And the normal track will take us on spiritually to apply the lessons. This other thing is controlled by Ahriman and Ahrimanic forces. It will take a portion of humanity and chain them to this separate evolution, which is artificial. So this is the great battle that takes place behind the scenes, as Steiner refers to it. And I think that when we look at what Casey was talking about in terms of the Atlantean period and how the Belial group operated in this fashion, we have the same thing going on, because the original followers of the Law of One wanted to use the technology to interact with higher spiritual forces, because they found a way to do that directly while still in a human body, which is an incredible advancement. The Belial groups used the same technology to destroy their enemies. And, you know, the histories, a lot of those histories sound pretty hardcore about the technology that was applied in doing it. So the other thing I think that's important for us to keep in mind when thinking about the Belial groups and how that is exactly like the Ahrimanic fashion is, Ahriman seems to be moving through technology also and setting up this situation where we're facing now in the process of only maybe 100 years of having technology and only 50 of having kind of computer technology. of actually moving into transhumanism, where people are talking about projecting their consciousness into robots and things like that, and trying to make that acceptable in society and getting rid of the idea of, you know, with the transhumanist thing, destroying any idea of gender, of male, female gender. And then going further with it, destroying the idea that, you know, humanity has a future in a sense. And there's, you know, you get this whole kind of transhumanist babble about how humans are bad for the planet and this kind of thing. So I think that we can see and we can identify the harmonic forces that the Mystery School of Anthroposophy has put forward. Because remember, Anthroposophy and Theosophy and groups like that were engineered by the Mystery Schools and by, like, the Great White Brotherhood, who decided in this period of time, and Steiner says it's 1840, which I think is a pretty good match for the time, they decided humanity is done if we don't get them out of the bonds of the scientific materialism. They decide within 100 years, it's a done deal. You won't be able to save these people. They will become such automated products of the system, so they could see the whole thing coming. That's why we got the wave of the Mystery Schools. But something else very special happened in between. The Mystery Schools, from Theosophy, through the work of Casey, and through Steiner's Anthroposophy, promised a kind of renaissance 100 years later. And the quotes over and over again are replete with saying the cycle's coming around again. So they knew something was going on. And I think it must be that many people are looking at the situation currently and saying, what's going on here? You know, the technological aspect, it's not to withdraw from technology and become a Luddite. I'm not saying that they're suggesting that. If anything, what Steiner's saying is we need to dive right into the heart of the situation and extract from that battle of facing this technological future, which he says is the war of all against all. That's what Ahriman is setting up, along with his own incarnation, probably through something like a really advanced D-wave. So I think that this gets really deep into understanding anthroposophical thought. It gets deep into understanding what the Great White Brotherhood Mystery Schools were trying to put forward. And it helps us to understand what the stealth archives are referencing and what the ex-steganography has been protecting us from all of these years and what the hassle is about. The kind of technology and situation that it represents actually threatens humanity on a global scale and into their spiritual future. So I think when we look at Edgar Cayce's work and when we look at Steiner's work through Anthroposophy and we look at the amazing things that Annie Besant did, we're seeing really that they were trying to tell us something. Now, they were sworn to a certain kind of secrecy, but they're trying to tell us that, that this is actually a kind of rendition of Belial, by the way. I forgot to show that, but that's kind of Old Testament-y, but it's a somewhat devilish look. So when we look at figures like some of this picture of Besant, and we see them working overtime in that period and dedicating their lives to developing these schools and these concepts to get out there, we have a better understanding of what it was all about. And that's crucial. And of course, that people like Blavatsky go in creating the whole movement that ultimately will have people like Steiner come through it, because Theosophy is a great training ground for Anthroposophy. So this is the nature of the situation. And whereas yesterday we tied in the Mystery School to the technology of Bavarians and the Lincoln School and the Lincoln Laboratories and Pine Gap, we can see how all that relates now on a much different level, this higher kind of astral version, astral view of what's happening really there. And in Steiner's outline, and I think this is really well supported by Casey's work, there's a gigantic sweep, a movement of this harmonic force into our everyday lives. And that is Steiner's great contribution to the 21st century. And this is where we are now. And with that, I am going to turn it all over to Olivia.
Wow. I have to say, this, I think, is the favorite, is my favorite episode we've ever done.
Yes.
Even though I couldn't focus on what you were saying, the chat has been incredible. And it's,
can you ever focus on what
no,
I'm saying?
No, really, I can't. But I just love the topic so much. So anyway, let's just dive right in. Occult priestess, does DJ think humanity is evolving? New human psychic light body beings.
Absolutely. It's great to see you out there, occult priestess. Well, one of the fascinating things that I found in looking through the Atlantean material is that early on when we were kind of etheric and just projecting ourselves in physically, according to the Casey material, that the way that we used eyes was when we needed them, we would develop them. So if you needed an eye on your wrist, or if you needed an eye somewhere, that's how it would come about. I do find this fascinating because we've heard so much about the third eye and how Casey describes, of course, that we had an actual eye up here, which became the pineal gland. I don't think there's any question if you look through the history of these mystery schools like anthroposophy and theosophy, they understood we were moving into a sixth root race, which is a much more psychically aware physical setup, which I think is important. As a matter of fact, one of the things that Besant said about the sixth root race was that they had such sensitive nervous systems that it was going to be very important for them to get out of the cities because it was going to prove to be a bad state of affairs. And when I was thinking about that, I was thinking about all these cases of autism and all these different things along that line. So that's an excellent question.
JJK, DJ, where do you see, in your opinion, humanity going in these difficult times?
Well, we're definitely set up against a precipice of making a tough choice. But it's, you know, it could go either way. You know, that's not a very informed answer, I guess, but that seems to be how it feels. I do feel like right now what's ramping up is the transhumanism and the war vibe. And when you see those two together, it's not a very good thing. But ultimately, I have to say what's rising up and what is so crucial is this message that there was a foundation laid over the past couple hundred years for us to apprehend something deeper. This is why I feel like when we do things in alternative research and when we're getting the message out about these things, we can't really waste time with the fluff stuff. you know, and I have a very kind of very focused, laser-like focus to move these topics forward because we're given such an incredible legacy by the people that I've been talking about tonight and in the whole X series, that I think that we need to make a move not to waste time. And what I see in alternative research space very often is a lot of time wasters and a lot of blind alleys and a lot of marketing. So what I'm looking for, and you always have to look for it in yourself first, is I'm looking for good material that people can use to advance their awareness and knowledge about the true situation on planet Earth. Now, that has to include a spiritual aspect, and when it doesn't, you're missing a lot. It also has to include the larger historical picture, and you know, for me, I think that that's crucial.
Ice Angel, is Lucifer the same as Ahriman, or are they two different beings? And does moving on mean ascension?
Ice Angel, it's good to have you here, and it's a fantastic question. They are two different beings, and I had an actual description. Let's see if I can find that, because I can have Steiner answer your question across the era, the eons. If he doesn't, I will. But I do find it fascinating. They are two different beings. What I understand about the Luciferian name is it's used incorrectly, and that is the problem. Here is a passage now which Steiner kind of differentiates Ahriman from Lucifer. Let's see. So this is Steiner answering your question. These two figures, Lucifer and Ahriman, must be clearly distinguished from each other. For Lucifer is a being who detached himself from the spiritual hosts of heaven after the separation of the sun. Whereas Ahriman had already broken away before the separation of the sun and is an embodiment of quite different powers. The result of Lucifer's influence in the Lemurian epoch was merely the corruption of the faculty still possessed by man in the Atlantean epoch to manipulate the forces of air and water. Let's see, moving down a little bit. I've told you that when these forces are drawn forth, they are connected in a mysterious way to nature forces in wind, weather, and the like. And if applied by man for purposes running counter to the divine purposes, these nature forces are called into action against him. Here lies the cause of the Atlantean flood and the devastation wrought by the powers of nature, which led to the disappearance of the whole continent of Atlantis. Power over the forces of fire and earth in certain combinations had already been withdrawn from man, but now, through the influence of Ahriman and his accomplices, he again acquired a certain mastery over the forces of fire and earth with dire consequences, and much that is to be heard about the use of fire in ancient Persia is connected with what I am telling you now. So this is a fascinating answer, and I know it's pretty wide-ranging, but let me boil that down for you. Basically, what he's saying is that the impact of Ahriman is much more visceral. It's much more physical. And that the impact of the Luciferian forces had to do with drawing men's souls away from Earth. What Ahriman's goal is to keep men embedded in the Earth and keep them chained to a different kind of evolutionary pattern. So I guess you would say that Steiner's saying it's a much bigger, that the Ahrimanic forces are really what we call the devil. That is, Ahriman is really what we know of as the devil. It's a much more visceral kind of evil.
Do you feel a sense of urgency because we are running out of time to thwart Ahriman?
Well, I wouldn't like to think we're running out of time, but I do feel like the situation has escalated dramatically and that a lot of the information coming through people as they look at the situation who are smart and coming in from different angles are seeing, you know, they're seeing aspects that don't seem like the people who are in charge, the leadership, is planning on kind of a bright future of humanity moving forward. So something strange is happening, I would say, over the period of the past, let's say since 9/11. And that includes the surveillance, the space fence, and the movement of technology to replace human beings and the kind of automated thing where they want us to go for robot bartenders. And, you know, a certain amount of this is laughable because human beings will always have this kind of excess quality going. But the kind of push that's going on behind the scenes on the leadership side would lead me to believe that the world is in such an Ahrimanic state that we need to up our game knowledge-wise and in terms of application, which is why I said it's very important not to waste time on some of the flightier stuff that comes through in alternative research. I think we need something, the ability to be very serious right now. And, you know, we have incredible information. These mystery schools and the ones that have come forward, like the work of Casey or Steiner or Besant, it's such an incredible foundation. So we have the tools. So let's use them.
Peter Bayonne, do the elites know they're working for Ahriman?
Some of them do. Some of them sure do. The thing about it is, when you get into that system, Ahriman likes to work things in an unconscious fashion in Steiner's description. He likes you to be unconsciously accepting these things. And with mankind, what he's trying to say is, hey, look, you know, you figured out things science-wise. You're the god now. You figured out the Big Bang. Everything's hunky-dory. You don't have to worry about your spiritual side anymore. In the meantime, he prepares to collect humanity for the eighth sphere. That is what Steiner's setup is. It's a fascinating thing. I think that the whole thing about the eighth sphere is a deep, deep mystery school secret that Steiner felt he had to let out, and probably it was associated with this on the approach of World War One, which was so devastating that he felt that he needed to let certain things out the same way the mystery schools decided in 1840 to let certain things out. Excellent questions, by the way. Thank you. And I want to remind everyone here to definitely, we're going to take a couple more questions, but remember,
we're going to go for questions for a long time. There are so many fantastic questions.
Okay, good, good, good. Yeah. Well, we'll keep up as many as we can, but the point I was going to make, why don't you tell them, Olivia, where they can go?
Well, I'm going to put some links up and you can subscribe at the Dark Journalist website.
Great. Fantastic. And sign up for the newsletter, because that's the way that we stay in touch. It's an absolutely crucial thing for us to have that ability, because of all this net neutrality stuff. I really think that there's a decided move to try to knock out a lot of the alternative media aspects. We've seen some moves against it, and, you know, I feel like the larger media outfits are now working in collusion in a way to, you know, kind of tighten their grip, and that in a way that they haven't worked as tightly together before. They seem to be so united to really disturb and disrupt the independent media that I think it's absolutely important to apply and get behind the media sites that you enjoy. You know, so I always like to mention the great ones. Cryptogon.com is a fantastic news source. Alexandra's Forbidden Knowledge, TV.net. She's a frequent guest on here. She's a good friend, and she's going to come back on the show soon, actually. Solari.com, darkjournalist.com. You want to go there. You know, GizaDeathStar.com. These are the sites that are going to give you the information that you need. And, you know, they're coming from a place of service. That, you know, I was talking about attunement and service. And, how we can really get to the bottom of all this by using that, which is, it's important to attune yourself and then to find a way to serve. Well, these sites will serve you because of the information that's there. And some of that information, you know, I've been really deep in the news end of things for a number of years. And it makes an incredible impact when you have solid information to go from. So those are the sites you want to get behind. But yeah, sign up for the newsletter and subscribe at the site while you're there. Okay, what else you got?
Terry Moran, do you believe in crystal energy, DJ? And JJK, what, in DJ's opinion, if these crystals existed, what happened to them?
Excellent, excellent question. I'm going to start with that one, which is, I think that something like we see in the Bermuda Triangle, and that these things that pull ships down, I think it's still that crystal working in reverse. And it may have messed up the entire evolution of the physical Earth, the way that it went down, but it certainly might still have that impact. Of course, we've had all kinds of weather anomalies. I saw an incredible story about this ship in 1976 and a real interview with the captain. This is no fly-by-night story. And he just was moving along through the Bermuda Triangle, and he runs into this thing that they can see, and it's a gigantic surface that's just there suddenly, and it's towering. It's metallic. And he says, well, what are we going to do, basically? And their engines start to freak a little bit. But this thing is half in the water, kind of half out of the water, and gigantic. And he basically makes the decision, let's get the hell out of there. But they're all kind of disturbed by this cosmic disruption. You know, they all feel a little bit out of their bodies and everything else with whatever was going on there. So this is part of that effect that I talk about, the apotheum, because when we encounter these things, we're encountering that interaction. And it can be brought about through technology. There's no question about it. I think the X technology is hardcore. But I think in terms of the crystal itself, it could be down there. Now, interestingly enough, Casey said that there were instructions on how to construct it in the Hall of Records that were placed in Egypt, and also in the Hall of Records that were placed in the Yucatan and the ones that were in Poseidia that sank, which may rise again, and everyone figured was the Bimini Wall because he identified the year 68 is when they found it. So I actually think we're going to see those records at some point. And it's pretty valuable if we can get our hands on them.
Brenda Fisher, does Armin's power over fire relate to the strange fire referenced in a previous episode?
Well, I think we're coming up against celestial fire, cosmic fire, fire. We're talking in Casey terms about pulling down the fire and activating the crystals. There's an occult kind of esoteric way of looking at fire, and then there's the actual physical fire. And I think that in truth, we're hovering right in the center, right in the hardcore center with this. There's something interesting about this term strange fire that keeps coming up over and over again when we're going through these texts and we're looking at anything related that goes back with the X as a symbol. We run into that fire thing over and over again. Plato's incredible cross, you know, the cosmic X that involves fire, and the ceremonies that they did involve fire. St. Andrew's cross involved fire. So the strange fire, I think, is a major key, because what is it referencing? And of course, in the Bible, when the strange fire comes up, people always, you know, disintegrate, right? They're offering strange fire at this altar by the Ark of the Covenant, and they're out of there in a heartbeat. So it's incredibly potent effect of the technology. There's no question about it.
All right, let's go into the eighth sphere. There are a couple questions. The Black Zionist, everything the Dark Journalist is saying is happening as we speak with the terraforming of chemtrail atmosphere, eighth sphere. Gregory Good just asked, could the eighth sphere be something like the world of the Matrix movies?
Wow. You know, it's funny. Olivia, you made the same point about the Matrix, mm-hmm. right? When we were talking about it last night.
Yep.
Here's the deal. The chemtrail aspect is to create, as best I can see it from Elena Freeland's work, which I think is amazing. And we've talked at length about this, and she knows a great deal about Steiner, having been a Steiner educator, teacher herself. The chemtrails are to create an atmosphere on Earth to ionize the atmosphere. What that's for, you know, she has her theories about what they're going to use that for. It would be interesting to have someone look at that from a more astral perspective, looking at it from an esoteric edge, trying to figure out what they're doing with it. But certainly it's the same type of thing. There's no question about it.
Bill Ferry says, Casey spoke of a princess of fire when Atlantis had degenerated to mm-hmm. human sacrifice.
It's true. What they did was, the Belial group used the same setup of training these priestesses to work with the crystals. But what happened was they realized in what they were doing that they could get the same type of reaction. And so they utilized the idea of sacrifice. And so this became, because they couldn't reach up to those higher levels spiritually to achieve this interaction. So somehow the sacrifice that they were doing with fire was also activating the crystal. So this is absolutely amazing. What I find interesting also, when you look at those, you can find a lot of references in there to, for example, this Mayan priestess trained in the tradition of the Atlanteans to welcome and interact these visitors from other worlds. I find that fascinating because not many people talk about Casey referencing the whole off-world civilization aspect, but I think it's important. But you can also see that there's so much mystery in the Atlantean spiritual descent into Earth and all the incredible things that happened and their godlike powers, that talking just about ancient aliens when it comes to that history is a very small aspect of what's going on there. The real thing that's happening, and of course, the Atlanteans had that interplay with those off-world civilizations, but it seems like whatever was going on with the evolutionary process giving us these godlike powers is is a really fascinating study and so very pertinent to what's happening right now, because we apparently have attained this level again.
Najat has my favorite question of the night,
hey.
Which is, could Armin be what Catherine Austin Fitz calls Mr. Global?
Well, he's the ultimate, right? I think it's interesting. You know, Steiner, when we look at this Armin sculpture that he made, he definitely depicted an individual. So, you know, just like we have a kind of Christian wave, which has an individual at the center, which is Christ, you have these kind of vessels. So what happens is these people train and then they want the Christ to inhabit them. So that's where we get the Essenes and all this stuff. They were setting up to have the Messiah come through their line, and so that they could be vessels moving out for that. And the disciples of Christ are the same thing. They want to achieve a certain kind of purity where Christ can kind of inhabit it and inhabit them and work through them. I think it's also true on the other side, which is that you have these individuals who can attain such a level of kind of occult mastery on the night side forces that you will have something where an Armonic presence can inhabit those figures. So the force, what I would say is Mr. Global is certainly Armonic. And it certainly has an Armonic force behind it.
All right, sure. Let's lighten up for a little bit. okay, so Rick Knight, who is the modern Ingo Swann, Casey Steiner? Are we in a vacuum? And Freethinker wants to know which Casey books you recommend. There are so many.
Edgar Casey on Atlantis is a fantastic book. I think that, you know, Jess Stern did a good job on the bio side. It's a 60s book, but it captures the Casey bio, I think, very well. And Sidney Kirkpatrick's work around Casey's life and the readings, I think, are also quite valuable. But Mysteries of Atlantis Revisited, which I talked to Edgar Evans Casey about before he passed away, and he felt that, you know, he had written Edgar Casey on Atlantis, which is my favorite Casey Atlantis book. Mysteries of Atlantis Revisited was when he went back and looked at if there were developments that matched up with what Casey said, and both of those books are extraordinary. An incredible book, often overlooked, even though it's the name of their magazine, is Venture Inward by Hewlin Casey, dealing with meditation and the Casey's view of discarnates and all of these different things. You get an incredible education on that whole end of the spectrum, so I highly recommend Venture Inward, which is about 1964, I would say. is that light enough for you?
I'm sorry, I'm getting ready
so
for
far,
the next,
so good.
Next question. So, Titan-Blooded, Space Fence, Soul Trap, Quarantine Zone, how do these fit together?
Say that again.
Okay, so we got Space Fence, Soul Trap, Quarantine Zone.
Okay. Here's the thing on the Space Fence that you need to know. First thing is, it apparently is a way to track things on Earth down to the DNA level. That's what it's been set up for. Also, that its ostensible purpose is to grab space garbage and make sure that something like Skylab doesn't fall on a populated area. So it's very easy to funnel money into a project like that. The third thing is that Lockheed, the United States of Lockheed, has a major role in it, which is always, it's pretty problematic knowing the forces behind Lockheed. So it's a very, very serious situation. I would say the space fence is a crucial issue for us all to get on board with. And I think that Elena Freeland did the yeoman's work of putting it together. And I understand that, you know, the book itself, from speaking with her, took years in development. So I think there's valuable information in there for us, but it's going to become a major issue for 2018. It's something that we really need to take a deep look at, including the its roots, which start in SDI Star Wars in the 1980s.
BV, was Blavatsky influenced by occult imprisonment while writing The Secret Doctrine?
According to Steiner, she was. Now, you will notice that the first book, Isis Unveiled, is an incredible book, but it is not so laden with the Buddhist push. So it's not so much that she was being interfered with. It's that the Eastern initiators had taken over while the Western initiators had withdrawn. So they had decided originally, the Western initiators from the mystery schools, they were going to work with Blavatsky because she seemed like basically the most powerful psychic. But because she got into these situations and because some of her past lives included a slightly distorted version of Christianity, because she had been through some pretty harsh things, as many of us have in our past lives, in the name of the Christianity, you know, there's so many different things that people have used that for, getting far, far away from the actual tradition and religion. So that became a real stumbling block, and the Western initiators decided, you know, because it's an active thing, it's not like they're all knowing and nothing happens. I mean, it's a free will world. And even though they're incredibly advanced, they're working in real time with us. And we, as little gods, basically, have the ability to say yes to this and no to that. So we're in a situation where a lot of willpower and free will gets exercised. So just like they came forward and helped Blavatsky, they had withdrawn, according to Steiner, and the Eastern initiators, who were more on that tip of influencing a kind of renaissance around Buddhism, moved in. So that's the real kind of distortion or problem there. But, you know, The Secret Doctrine is an amazing work. I've been kind of revisiting it, and it's incredible. I mean, the fact that this stuff was even allowed to come out in the first place is just wild. I can't imagine being there in the late 19th century and having this book show up with all these esoteric secrets. And Steiner himself gives Blavatsky incredible credit for doing something that no one else had done at that time. And he said that Isis Unveiled was really, like, basically one of the top esoteric books that had ever been published.
David Termina, what did Steiner ultimately hope for humanity?
Wow, that's a big one. Well, there's no question. Anthroposophy is also a little out of this world. I mean, he really thinks that we're heading toward this incredible development of our faculties as spiritual beings and developing into this new Earth, which is basically this incredible version of Jupiter. So he has a very hopeful future in mind for us. And I think that he wants to see us in this spiritual harmony evolving on this track and really developing into the full beings. And his grasp of the history, because he was a scholar, because he was somebody that was trained in that, but also had this amazing spiritual ability, he's the most educated of all of the mystics that came forward from the mystery schools. And that's why I think his work stands out so much. Someone mentioned Manly P. Hall. Manly P. Hall was also extraordinary. And the fact that he wrote The Secret Teachings of All Ages when he was still in his 20s is remarkable. But
and,
yes, certainly.
Well, his lectures are up on YouTube, and they are fantastic.
Yeah, they do. They have some there. And that is someone who, like Joseph Campbell, with their voice, so much comes through it. Okay,
especially, well, and they're better when he gets older. They're the ones with his gravelly and elderly are the best lectures.
It's true.
Bill Ferry, just wanted to mention Harmon Breaux's books on Casey are great. And of course,
I met Harmon Breaux. Yeah, I had extraordinary conversations with Harmon Breaux, and I think he was there working with Casey in the last couple of years of Casey's life, and he led an incredible life. And A Seer Out of Season is his book. I highly recommend his approach. He was also very well educated and grounded, but incredibly open-minded, which is really a fantastic combination that is important when someone can think critically, but also knows when to be open-minded enough to accept good information, but really knows how to call a spade too. And in the alternative research world, you need to be able to do that because a lot of junk is engineered around it and a lot of junk conspiracy. So Bro is really one of the top Casey guys. I agree. Okay, we'll take a couple more questions.
Okay, so where do you think the study of X will take us, and how close are we to being ready for the truth?
Well, we're on this journey of the X together, and so the question is, where is it? Where has it taken you in the past couple of months? We've learned a lot of things that literally were not there. I study all of these different areas, and I can tell you what was in the literature versus what was not in the literature. And the things that we've discovered and put connections for the dots to, is no question that it's definitely an earthquake around this information, because we've discovered stealth archives. We've discovered the X steganography, and that can really open things up, because once you discover a formula, there's kind of no way for someone to shut you down, because with the formula, you can go back through all the different years that they've used it and trace it back. You know, some people around the JFK assassination, for example, the information that I can get, because it's 55 years and it's unraveled, you know, it takes a while for that kind of deep state cover to unravel. And the covert forces that set up these types of things, they know how to cover their tracks so well. But after 50 years, we get a much better picture. It's a much easier thing to go after than, say, 9/11, which even after 17 years is very difficult to unravel in a full sense. So in terms of those deep events. So, but in terms of the X steganography, we've learned that the X is associated deeply with the UFO file, for example, and we've also seen its relation to the mystery schools, and really the consequences of that are, you know, the possibilities, the potentialities of opening up knowledge is kind of unlimited, because we can open up to a whole new range of information based on the X steganography. And we've already developed information here in the past 10 episodes that changes a lot. It changes everything. I mean, it changes our understanding of World War II and Theosophy's role in developing the Varians, and the Varians' role in developing CERN and the deep space monitoring, and also the role of Pine Gap. I mean, it goes on and on and on, and the research runs deep. I think that we've really got it. And, you know, it's a process here with us. It's I do my deep research, and you guys are looking at a range of things, and together we're kind of putting that knowledge together.
Okay, two more questions. Tainted Honor, who is the single most influential and iconic person in the UFO / X / disclosure arena, and why?
Well, see, Frank Scully discovering the Aztec case and setting off the X and giving us the X file idea in 1950 is crucial. So it's a series of incidents. It's hard to pin it down to a particular person. Frankly, you know, there are great researchers who've done yeoman's work in this area, like Stanton Friedman, like Linda Moulton Howe. You're going to get incredible information working with them. John Mack's research working with the larger concept. And remember, this is a Harvard professor putting his neck on the line. So people have sacrificed a lot. So we have to remember that, not to settle for Tom DeLonge and the CIA coming along and saying, UFOs are a threat, give us money. You know, there's a tradition there, and we have to remember to have backbone when it comes to these incredible marketing pushes, and to call out, you know, the outlets, the media outlets that carry that stuff and say, this is junk and this is why. So, but in terms of who's the best, well, I've named a few incredible ones there. I think the crucial thing about the UFO file right now is that we're understanding the upper level of how presidents dealt with it. And that's important because I think there's a large scale disconnect. And I think the last president that had any idea of what was happening with it was Reagan. What else you got?
Okay. So this will be what we end on. So it's a 3-part question.
Okay.
Sandy Shores. So how do we fight the Archons? Leilani G responded to that saying, overcoming Archonic rule requires we claim our light being selves as our true form. They cannot control us when we are light beings. And Tim F asks, so what can we do to protect the natural evolution of mind and mankind? And yeah. I wanted to insert here the whole, because there's a lot of debate on the chat about it. What Gurdjieff talks about, that we are all the laws that we're under, because, you know, it's not a simple answer.
Yeah, well, it's fascinating. You know, when we did this episode on Casey and Steiner and the incredible contributions from the mystery schools, and of course, the most recent one was dealt with Theosophy and their incredible contributions. But Gurdjieff is worthy of a show in himself and the incredible movement that he started. And he, there's no question about it with the Enneagram and everything else. He's going to come up deep in here as we go forward in the X research. Gurdjieff really was somebody who had gone through and touched on the modern mystery schools. And I think that they had kind of seen him as an experimental project to see what would happen with it. And one of the interesting things, I think, is that he taught this idea of self-remembering. And he said that you can work with machines, but become more human and less mechanical. And that the problem of modern humanity was that it was asleep and acting too mechanical and was becoming the plaything for the laws of the situation. And that the more laws applied to us, we were becoming on the evolutionary track under these laws where we weren't utilizing aspects of our spiritual selves. Now, his road was very different, though, however, because Gurdjieff didn't deal with the notion of reincarnation, didn't deal with a lot of the psychic stuff. Most of it was about self-memory, self-awareness. But one thing that is so crucial that came out of Gurdjieff's work, and I have to say Gurdjieff, I think, is one of the greatest, is this idea that we shouldn't identify with things, and that identification was an incredible problem, and that we had a series of eyes within us, a series of personalities, which by being self-aware, we could get a handle on, because each time a different eye popped up, it was like someone being a king for a day. And I think we know a number of people like that. But what's fascinating is this, which is that he was basically saying that our chief feature is that we're not aware of what's happening, and that the whole thing was about becoming more awake and more aware. And I always see this in political circles. You see someone screaming their head off and going, wake up, wake up. And you realize that, you know, they're about to have a stroke. There's nothing awake about that. And so this is, you know, being awake is being centered and being objective. So this idea of identifying, just like they're going to try to make us identify with a war against Iran, or they're going to try to make us identify with being against Trump or being for Trump, or they're going to try to fake us out with, you know, phony Q or something like that. You know, it's important, I think, that we maintain a kind of center and objective point of view in dealing with very hot button issues around politics. And the Gurdjieff work can really help you do that. So there's an incredible tool there on the self-memory of the Gurdjieff work. So that's something that is absolutely fascinating. And by the way, you know, if you look at Ouspensky, who was his chief student before he encountered Gurdjieff, all of his work was influenced by Steiner and Blavatsky. And there's a weird crisscross because this gentleman, Edgar Casey, gave a reading when someone was asking about Ouspensky. And actually, oddly enough, when you asked that question, I remembered I wrote it down here. And if you can hang in there and bear with me, I will read it to you. It's short, but it is absolutely important. they were asking about Ouspensky, and he said Casey went into Ouspensky's past lives just spontaneously and said, we found he was the keeper of the records in the mount for the Maharba people, and the incredibly advanced individual. And Casey in this trance reading starts musing to himself, for you see Ouspensky, born on the seventh month, seventh day, seventh year, seven, 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 seven. Wow. What was it about Ouspensky that he was seeing there, looking at his records on the astral side? Fascinating stuff. Wow, it's been great to be with everyone tonight. I've seen some great people out there, and I'm very happy to see Christine Taggart.
Actually, since you just mentioned her, one more question.
Oh, yeah, okay, sure.
Just because it's such a great idea. So Christine Taggart says, DJ, we humans are the X, aren't we? The unknown? It's a very intriguing question.
Yes. Well, remember, X is used traditionally in a number of different ways. And certainly X, the unknown, we understand that. But, and remember always when we're looking for the X thing, we're looking for how it applies to the steganography that we're talking about. But certainly here we are in the center of it all, right? There's no question about it.
And we don't really know who we are and where we came from.
Oh, well, isn't that Graham Hancock's incredible quote that we're a species with amnesia? And that's a great quote for us to end on. Thank you, Christina, for a wonderful question, and for Najat and Sandy Shores, all these great people out there tonight. It's great to see you in the chat. And we did our two-part presentation for part X of the X series. That's the first wave of the X series. We're going to do another 10 episodes, but we're going to wait to start those up for a couple of weeks. But next Friday, we're back anyway with another live show here. And I'm also going to be on Hagman and Hagman on Tuesday night talking about the well-worn political scene and some of the surprises going on there. But Friday night, we'll be back here at 7 p.m. And it'll be great to see you. Olivia, outstanding job.
Thank you. It was so fun tonight. Thank you, everyone.
She did a great job. She's got the magic. And we'll see you at darkjournalist.com. Remember, sign up for the newsletter. That's the way we stay in touch. It's a free newsletter, and definitely contains all the information on the shows that are coming up. And also, feel free to subscribe to the site. It's, you know, we've made it inexpensive on purpose, so it'd be very easily accessible. But that kind of support behind the things that are important, behind the show, get behind it. This is the thing that we need to do now. And the X shows will continue. That is the end of the first wave, and I've really enjoyed bringing them to you. And thank you for being such a great, informed, and patient audience. So we will see you next week, and have a great night.
Good night.
Hey, what's for dinner, by the way?
Hot stickers tonight.
It sounds like a fantastic idea. Thanks, everyone.